Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. Many of us are involved in political activism, especially if you're tuned into this show. But what happens when you have kids? In my own life, I can remember being so involved about 10 years ago, you know, in anti-war activism, journalism, anti-racist actions, going to meetings and joining committees, marching and protests. And then I started to have children, and suddenly life felt like it split into the pre-childbirth and post-childbirth eras. The former is full of vigor and questioning and rebellion. The latter, more often than not, is consumed with diapers and school choices, choosing the right pediatrician, ensuring healthy diets, and schlepping kids to and from soccer practice, worrying about being able to afford piano lessons, and on and on. Can one live a life true to one's political values and have children? My guest, Frida Bergen, writes about how her parents, who were high-profile activists, raised three children and how she attempts to navigate a similar path. Frida Bergen serves on the board of the War Resisters League and helped to found the group Witness Against Torture. She's also worked as a researcher with New America Media's Arms and Security Initiative and also as a columnist for Waging Nonviolence. And she's a mother who's just written the book It Runs in the Family on being raised by radicals and growing into rebellious motherhood. And today, as part of our ongoing series on the politics of parenting, we're proud to welcome Frida to the program. Hi, Frida.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. Thanks for joining us. Well, first, tell us about your parents and your family. The name Bergen is synonymous with activism in the U.S.
Right. So Phil Bergen and Liz McAllister are my parents. They founded the Jonah House community in Baltimore, Maryland. And right before I was born, they were active in the anti-Vietnam War movement. My father was part of the Catonsville Nine, a group of nine people, of course, who burned draft files and then stayed to take responsibility for that action and carried the witness into the courtroom.
And Frida, we're going to call you on the phone while keeping your video active since the audio doesn't sound so good. So while we're doing that, let me just tell our listeners and our viewers that I'm speaking with Frida Bergen, who serves on the board of the War Resisters League, and she helped to found the group Witness Against Torture, and her book is called It Runs in the Family, on being raised by radicals and growing into rebellious motherhood. It's part of our ongoing series on the politics of parenting, which, by the way, if you want to listen to or watch our other interviews in that series, you can simply go to uprisingwithsonali.com. Frida, are you back with us?
Yes, I am.
Okay, great. So, yeah, so if you can just continue the story you were telling about your family.
Oh, sure. So the Catonsville Nine happened in 1968. My parents were both involved in high-profile anti-Vietnam War activity, went to jail for long periods of time as part of that, and then in the 1970s, after founding Jonah House, began to be anti-nuclear weapons activists that were part of founding the Plowshares movement. Hundreds of Plowshares actions have now taken place throughout the United States and also in Europe. And these are actions where a small group of people go onto nuclear weapons facilities and do a symbolic transformation of nuclear weapons. Hmm. That movement just got sort of a high-profile treatment in the New Yorker magazine in an article by Eric Schlosser. Throughout all of these activities, you know, my parents had three children.
And I understand they didn't really want children, and they were planning on not having children, but they ended up with you and your siblings.
Yeah, you know how that happens sometimes. So they wanted to commit themselves fully to this work of revolution, of societal transformation, of bringing about peace and justice, didn't really see that children would fit into that. And then, of course, we did fit into that. They were helped very much by the fact that we lived in community. We lived with as many as 10 other people at different times. So responsibility for childcare was spread throughout the community in the same way that cooking meals and cleaning and contributing to the household economy was spread throughout the community.
Now, you write in your book that your parents found or counted that they spent a total of something like 11 years imprisoned for various radical political actions while you were children. How did that impact your family life? How does a family function when that happens?
Well, really, we continued to relate to one another mostly through letters, and so my childhood was written. You know, my parents wrote letters to us every day when they were away from us, when they were in prison. We wrote letters or dictated letters before we learned how to read and write, and we worked very, very hard at it. Our parents worked very hard at it. As small children, we never really we saw our parents go off to jail very, very happy, very resolute, very strong. And it wasn't until we were much older that we realized that it was very difficult. It was very heart-wrenching for them to be separated from us. So they really accentuated the positive when we were small. They told us that it was our responsibility as that our work as kids was, was to be good, to do our chores, to follow the directions of the other adults that were taking care of us, and that this was our piece of the piecework. And so we did that.
So being responsible children was your contribution to a better world.
That's right. That's right. And so we did that, and they did their part by which was, was being in prison. They tried very hard not to be in prison at the same time, and were largely successful. I write in book about what was, in the grand scheme of things, a very short period of time of about 3 months, but was a really difficult period because my brother and I were both very young, and responsibility for taking care of us fell to two members of our community. And so after that experience, they tried and succeeded, as far as we can all remember, in not being in prison at the same time.
So now you found your life partner. You have children. I understand your husband is a peace activist, so at least you're both on the same page philosophically, which I'm guessing is a big advantage to living your life according to your values. But also you write that the way in which you're raising your children in this modern day is not the same as the way your parents raised you while being activists, right?
Right. Well, I think the big difference is that we don't live in an intentional community. You know, we have a household, and the five of us live here and don't share physical space with other people. And the other...
Whereas when you were growing up, it was a communal living situation?
Right. We lived, there were maybe as many as a dozen people living in our household. The five of us are our family, and then, six, seven, eight other people who are part of the community. Mm-hmm. Mostly single people, but sometimes other families with little children as well. Mm-hmm. So that's one big difference. We don't live in an intentional community. And the other is that, my husband does have a job. He works for an organization that does domestic violence prevention and education, and then they run a shelter for victims and survivors of domestic violence. So in that way, our life is sort of somewhat typical. My husband goes off to work, and I stay home, at least for now, with these little children. We have a three-year-old, he's almost three, Seamus, and a one-year-old, Madeline, and then an eight-year-old, Rosina.
And you're, of course, writing and working from home, but you and your husband are war tax resistors. And by the way, we can still see you on video, Frida, just so you know, we're keeping you on your video. You intentionally try to earn as little money as you can so that you don't have to pay taxes to fund wars. But while you're trying to raise children, how do you do that? I mean, children cost money. They need clothes, good, healthy food. They may want to play sports or learn music or take lessons. How do you parent while earning not enough money to pay taxes, because you're intentionally doing that as a political statement?
Right. Well, sorry, I just had to plug in my computer here. Right. Well, we rely on a lot of hand-me-downs. We do things that are free or are very inexpensive. We are part of a community garden, and we grow a lot of our own food throughout the nicer weather. We share a lot of stuff. We only have one vehicle. We try not to drive it that much. We do a lot of walking and taking advantage of city resources like a free playgroup and other free activities. There's a recreation department where the kids can sign up for swimming lessons and sports and all of that kind of stuff with, that's very inexpensive and affordable. So we're just trying to live really close to the ground as we can.
Now,
Earthy Day talks about living with a sense of precarity, and so we live that way. You know, many people live in precarity, and we do as well, but in a sort of joyful precarity, if that's. I can say that.
Now, Frida, you have a chapter in your book on birthday parties, which I found very interesting. There's this culture of making birthday parties these days, huge affairs. Parents plan their kids' parties on Pinterest these days. I have to admit, I might have gone further down that path myself than I care to admit. But if you get invited to parties and you take your children to birthday parties that are super fancy and expensive, and your kid sees it and they want one too, and they want the goodie bags with all the plastic trash that you get into it that ends up in landfills, that really rifles your political feathers. How do you say no? How do you give them simple, low-waste, low-pressure parties that of the kinds that people used to throw? How can our children's birthday parties, for example, fit our moral compass today?
Right. I mean, I think it comes down to saying no and explaining why. So far, it has worked pretty well. Our 8-year-old, her birthday's right after Christmas. And so, she's actually, her birthday is, New Year's Eve. And so when, we have birthday parties, we invite her whole class and all of our friends. So, there's 25 kids running around. We do it at our church. We belong to a Unitarian Universalist congregation. So, we have this big that is very affordable.
Frida, we seem to have lost your audio.
Oh.
Oh, there you go. I think you're back.
Oh.
Continue.
Okay. We ask that people not bring presents because it's just been Christmas and, everybody's just spent way too much money and Rosina has gotten a ton of Christmas presents, so we draw a very hard line and say no presents, and then that gets us off the hook for any goodie bags or swag bags that we have to give out to other people.
How do you keep your children from resenting you for these things? I mean, my father grew up in a household that was headed by a member of the Communist Party. My grandfather, strong communist, very Spartan household, refused to let his son have any luxuries, wouldn't let my father get braces because he thought that was vanity. And my father rebelled and grew up and all, just wanted to be a capitalist. I have that fear about my children, that if I say no to the luxuries that are part of our consumer culture, that they grow up to resent you.
Well, I mean, check back with me, Sonali, in 10 years. But
you didn't resent your parents.
I didn't. I definitely wanted things. I definitely coveted the things I saw my classmates have. But I guess I had a framework to put things in. I had a framework for our simple living. And I knew that when my parents said, no, you can't have that nice thing, they weren't just saying no out of a political position. They were saying no because we did not have the money to afford it. And because it wasn't like they were wearing really nice clothes and, kind of fulfilling all of their desires and just saying no to me. We were all living this very Spartan kind of existence. And so, and the no was practical too. We just didn't have it. And so in a similar fashion, I mean, we are not, you know, neglecting our children. We're not denying them the basics. They do have a lot of fun. They enjoy life a lot. They just don't have a lot of just superfluous stuff. And we say no. Just the way we say no, my husband and I say no to our own desires to, what, like go out to dinner all the time or go see a lot of movies or, you know, just kind of
do you think, Frida,
do whatever we want whenever we want to do it.
Do you think that you're living your life in this way is actually a privilege? I mean, many Americans actually try to earn more, you know, enough to be able to pay taxes and can't. You know, they don't have the choice. They may be hauled off to prison without a choice. They may be forced to have their kids wear used clothing and have too little, again, not by choice. You and your husband have the ability to choose to live a certain way that not everybody has. Is that right?
Sure. It is a choice. It's a whole series of choices. And I'm certainly not saying everybody should live the way we're living. There is risk involved. In not paying taxes, there's sacrifices and choices that we're making to just be living with one income, but it does, you know, I mean, many families pay 2/3 of their income or one of their incomes in child care. A recent article, depending on where you live, you can pay, 47% of one of your incomes in childcare. And so that is an expense that we do not have.
Right.
And there are other expenses that kind of are ancillary to that. You know, when you have two parents working, you often need two cars. You come home from work and you don't want to cook dinner. You don't want to shop for groceries. You end up spending a lot more on food because you order in or you buy food that's already prepared,
right,
instead of buying, you know, the shopping from the outside of the grocery store, the outer ring of the grocery store instead of the inside of it. And so,
Frida, we've been talking about how our politics might get in the way of parenting. Let's talk about how parenting might get in the way of politics for those people who are political activists who don't have children by choice. It can be a political act to be childless. It can be simply a choice, you know, that someone might not want children, more power to them. But and your parents were intending to not have children, accidentally had them. What advice can you give to people worried that having kids might get in the way of political activism? Have you managed to maintain your values and your activism while being as good a parent as you can be?
Right. I think that's the big question, and I think that it comes down to what is politics and how do we live our politics, and do we live our politics in going to demonstrations and going to meetings? Or do we live our politics in the small choices that we're making every day and the small choices that we're making? And I think you can do both. And I think in some ways it comes down to, and this might sound sort of hokey, but in blooming where you're planted. And I think these early years of being a parent have been a real education for me in having to scale back my expectations of myself. I can't be everywhere I want to be. I can't be on the front line, so to speak.
And of course, women tend to bear the biggest brunt of this compared to fathers.
Oh, sure, yeah. You see lots of dads at meetings, and you don't see lots of moms at meetings. It is easier for fathers to kind of step outside of the home in many ways. And, I write in the book about this phenomenon of dads babysitting their children instead of parenting them. And, You know, every time my husband goes to the grocery store with our kids, you know, he gets a standing ovation from mostly from women, like, "Oh, you go, Dad! Like, good for you." And I never get a standing ovation going to the grocery
store. I'm giving you a standing ovation right now, Frieda. I want to thank you so much for joining us today, and best of luck with your book.
Oh, thank you. It was great to talk to you, Sonali.
My guest, Frieda Berrigan, serves on the board of the War Resisters League and helped to found the group Witness Against Torture. Her book is called It Runs in the Family, on being raised by radicals and growing into rebellious motherhood, part of our coverage on the politics of parenting.